You may recall my guest Graham Hancock, by great waves of popular demand and a U.S. tour, and I guess a quick trip to Japan, Graham is back, and I suspect that we have him this evening because his time zones probably are as fouled as time zones can get. Once you do enough flying, it all mixes together after a while. He is author of Fingerprints of the Gods, The Message of the Sphinx. It is an area of great fascination to many people. Let me give you the call-in numbers, because tonight, it's your turn. Graham Hancock. Hi, Graham.
Hi, Oz. How you doing?
Oh, great. Welcome to the program. Where are you now?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
Recovering from a 13-hour flight from Tokyo, Japan, as you rightly observed.
Yeah.
And I must say, these long flights really are. It does make you begin to realize that we really do live on a planet, and that it revolves as you fly into and out of darkness.
That's right.
You see the curvature of the Earth beneath you, and how small and how precious it all is, and how we are affected incredibly by the rhythms of life on this planet.
How are your rhythms? Are you
I'm not quite sure when I am or where I am, but I feel pretty good.
Well, your U.S. book tour was a smashing success, wasn't it?
Yeah. It went very, very well, and in fact I was in Japan for the same reason, because Fingerprints of the Gods was published in Japan 3 months ago, and it was it's just been an extraordinary success there. In fact, when I arrived, they announced that they'd sold 750,000 copies, 750,000 copies in 3 months. So
oh my gosh!
It's just gone completely crazy in Japan, and I was very excited by the visit. They're very, to my surprise, a very open-minded and welcoming people, and I had a great time there.
Graham, that's a good general question. Why do you think that this whole genre of investigation, this whole area, has gone so absolutely crazy? I mean, it just is exploding all over the world, just here in the U.S.
That's right. It's a universal phenomenon. It's happening everywhere, and I think that what it is that people are waking up everywhere to the big questions,
yes.
Getting less focused on trivial day by day issues, and asking themselves very, very large questions about who we are and why we are here and what is and you know, it sounds like the ultimate cliche, but what is the meaning of life? What is it all for?
Yes.
People are asking themselves these questions all around the world, and what the answer that they're coming to first and foremost is that what we've been spoon fed for the last century by our governments and by Orthodox religion and by our economists and by social leaders of all kinds is just not satisfactory at all, and people are looking in a much bigger framework these days and asking very large questions and looking for information that it just has not been made generally available. So people are on a quest, they're searching, they're looking, and this is leading.
Now, if I ask you that question, Graham, how do you answer? What, you know, that's the biggie. What is the meaning of life? What does Graham Hancock think it is?
Well, I'll tell you what I think it is. To the best that I can say, I think it's a mystery. I think life is a spiritual mystery. I didn't think this 10 or 15 years ago. I really did think that we were just a kind of chemical accident, a fairly unfortunate chemical accident at that. I've completely changed my view on all of these issues, and I think that we're involved in a very, very mysterious process that has to do with perfecting and equipping ourselves, preparing ourselves for something bigger and something beyond. I've come to regard life as an extraordinary opportunity to learn and to grow and to develop. And I don't think that anything that we learn, any experience that we encounter, any challenge that we overcome is wasted. I think it's all part of something that we add to ourselves as we go along. And I think that every time we take refuge in illusions of safety and security and fail to take the opportunities that life throws at us to transcend ourselves, I think we're letting ourselves down very, very badly. I've come to believe passionately that consciousness can and does survive death. And since I do believe that, I think that every moment I spend on this planet is precious and must not be wasted. That's a view I honestly and genuinely try to communicate to everybody I talk to.
So perhaps the meaning is not designed to be discerned. Maybe the meaning is the quest itself.
The meaning, you are absolutely right, Art. The meaning is the quest itself. This is the journey of life. It's to discover as best we can who and what we are. And because I have been immersed in ancient texts and ancient wisdom for so long now, I no longer ridicule such notions as reincarnation. I think probably we do come back in all kinds of different experiences and lifetimes, because one lifetime is not enough. There's a continual process of learning and growing and developing, and all the ancient religions say that eventually we reach a moment when we do transcend. And for the ancient Egyptians, we became, the ultimate objective was to become a star. Imagine that, become a star, become a sun in the sky, distributing life throughout the universe, full of light and warmth and altruism.
Can I ask you just a straight out question? I had somebody after your last appearance, they called me up and they said, it's ridiculous, you know, we could build the pyramids. Who's to say we couldn't build the pyramids? What is the evidence that we could not build the pyramids, or could not have them built the pyramids? What is the best evidence?
Well, the best evidence is that we haven't done it. We haven't built the pyramids, nor anything like them. We've built temporary, ugly, meaningless pieces of architecture all around the world that are not connected to any powerful spiritual force. You see, the pyramids, the three great pyramids of Egypt and the Great Sphinx, are much, much more than just three massive buildings.
Yes.
They are a place of spiritual transformation. They have an extraordinary effect upon the soul. And there is nothing that we build today which does that or which has that effect, because we have lost the knowledge of how to do so. Perhaps if we were to expend an enormous quantity of skill and effort and ingenuity, perhaps we could create something like the Great Pyramid. Although I can tell you there have been two attempts in modern times, one by an American team and one by a Japanese team, to build a pitiful little 30-foot high pyramid.
And what happened?
And they both failed.
They failed.
The Great Pyramid is more than 450 feet tall and weighs 6 million tons. These two modern attempts attempted to do the job, first of all using what they thought was the technology that was used in the building of the pyramids. And you have to understand that according to Orthodox theory, the ancient Egyptians had basic, very simple copper tools. They didn't have the wheel or anything like this. So initially, both of these teams, one was from Waseda University in Japan, another involved Mark Lehner of the Oriental Institute of the University of Chicago. They tried to do the job with simple tools. And the Japanese attempt was a total disaster. And Mark Lehner and his team managed to build one third of their pitiful little 30-foot tall pyramid before giving up. And what both of these attempts demonstrated, the Japanese actually had to give up using so-called ancient technology and started trying to use cranes. And even this failed. It was a dismal, laughable joke, and it shows that we don't actually even have the technical ability to do that job with that perfection on that scale. But the technical ability, to me, is much less interesting than the spiritual effect of these monuments.
How could they have done it, then?
Well, they knew something. They knew something, many things that we do not know. And actually, I don't know how they did it. All I know is they didn't do it the way that our scholars, our Orthodox scholars, tell us they did do it. That I'm sure of, as sure as I can be of anything on the face of this earth. They didn't build it with teams of unwilling workers and ramps a mile long. No, it wasn't done that way.
All right, before we get to phones, this is very important. I got several panicked communications. This is really interesting, Graham, from some people up in the Bay Area in San Francisco.
Yeah.
after the last program we did, and they were very, very concerned about the commercialization of the opening of the Sphinx.
Yes, I'm very concerned about it.
I know you are. But they wanted to do something, so they called the Egyptian embassy. And the person there at first kind of poo-pooed the whole thing and said, no, this isn't happening. And so the person then forwarded a lot of your information to this official in the embassy. And about 2 hours went by, and the call came, and the embassy guy was totally freaked out, to use the street term. I mean, he was very upset. He said, my family goes way back, and I'm sorry to say, but it looks as though your information is accurate.
Interesting.
So, yeah, interesting, right. So the question is, people who are disturbed about the manner of the procession of the opening of this, how do they, who do they respond to, who do they write to, How do they become active?
Let me tell you that just there's been a further development on this, because just today I gave a presentation on this matter after coming in from Japan and before having my nap. I gave a presentation on this matter to the Egyptian ambassador in Washington, and provided him with full documentation and asked him to look into this, and which he promised to do, because my impression is that. The majority of officials in the Egyptian government are not fully in the picture about what is happening. The control over the monuments of Giza has been delegated to a subcommittee within the Egyptian Antiquities Organization, and that subcommittee is deeply and powerfully influenced by a man called Zahi Hawass, who is the official responsible for the pyramids and the Sphinx. And Zahi Hawass is directly, personally involved in the project that is taking place at the Sphinx at the moment, and indeed plays a starring role in the ghastly commercial promotional videotape produced by the team who are working, who have got the license to do the work at the Sphinx. And I'm not sure how much further knowledge of this goes within the Egyptian government, but I think that that the more noise we all make about this, the more likely this horrific project is to be stopped.
All right, where do we direct the noise?
Well, I think that I believe very strongly in concentration of force, and while it would be good for people, I think that what needs to be done is to get a major newspaper or a major investigative television program in this country to actually go to Giza, to question all the officials involved, to question the Florida State University officials who are involved in this project. Four geologists from Florida State University are involved in the project. To question Joseph Schor, S-C-H-O-R, who is the individual through the Schor Foundation who is largely involved in financing this project, and to get full details on what is happening and to report this. And my knowledge of the American media is not as wide as it should be, but I would say that rather than send letters to lots of different programs or newspapers, it would be worth nominating one or two and have everybody write to them and say, we're concerned about this matter and we want it investigated.
All right, well, it's got to be somebody with the resources. I would say CBS's 60 Minutes might be a good target.
Yes.
And they have the resources to go there and do as you have suggested.
That's right.
Graham, what do you think's inside the chamber of the Sphinx?
Curiously enough, and I can only report this anecdotally without being able to tell you that it is definitely fact, we've had a leak of information from one of the people involved in the team working at the Sphinx. And that leak of information, and I repeat, I cannot confirm that this is definitely the case, but it is interesting because it's from one of the people who has been working at the Sphinx with this team in the last couple of months, using ground-penetrating radar and seismic equipment. And that leak of information says that they have found 9 underground chambers and that metallic objects have been identified in all of those 9 chambers.
No kidding.
That's the information that I was given.
How good do you think that information is?
I think it's pretty good. I think that it's the genuine article.
9 underground chambers, and they've located which are
they? According to their remote sensing equipment, these chambers contain metallic objects.
Is the equipment sensitive enough to discern the nature at all?
I know nothing more beyond beyond what I've told you just now. This was a leak of information. People who are working on this project are supposed to be sworn to secrecy and not to tell anybody anything about it. But this is the leak that we received.
Wow, that's some leak.
Yes. It is, particularly since if we examine the ancient Egyptian traditions concerning the quote-unquote fall of records, concerning the secrets, the great secret of the gods that they say is concealed at Giza. It speaks of books, documents, records going back to the time of the gods, and it says that this record chamber is guarded by metal statues of curious or strange abilities.
On that note, we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to come back and take calls. Holy mackerel. Boy, am I glad we had Graham back. That's some leak, isn't it? We'll be back with Graham Hancock, author of Fingerprints of the Gods and more in a moment. This is CBC. Big fan of cats. Somebody sent this one line to me that has stuck with me all day today that I absolutely love. It simply says, "Hi, Art. Thousands of years ago, Egyptians worshipped cats as gods. Cats have never forgotten this." That's it. Is that true, by the way? Did they worship cats as gods, Graham?
No.
No.
I think that there's a grave misunderstanding of the nature of Egyptian religion, and this has partly been spread by our Egyptologists who make it their business to try to trivialize as much as possible this extraordinary ancient civilization. Everything about ancient Egyptian religion is symbolic. It's symbolism. And they use symbolism at several different levels of meaning, and all the animal figures, the animal masks, which we see in Egyptian reliefs, have symbolic functions, and often these symbolic functions at root are astronomical. The feline symbolism in Egypt is, we're quite sure, is associated with the constellation of Leo, the lion constellation. Mm-hmm. And represents that constellation and the way that that constellation marks a particular age or epoch. And we find that same symbolism expressed in the Great Sphinx, which is a lion-bodied monument.
If we were able, if Graham Hancock were standing at the door, that first door leading to the first chamber beneath the Sphinx, and you were able to go through it, would you have trepidation or would you march right through?
No, I would have immense trepidation about going through it. These places are not meant to be marched into. I do think that they were meant to be found, but I think that that what is required is a period of preparation, of careful preparation, and that's one of the reasons, amongst many, why I think that the project currently granted a license by the Egyptian Antiquities Organization at the Sphinx must be stopped forthwith, and the license must be withdrawn while proper consideration is given to how this matter should be followed up. I do definitely believe that these chambers should be opened. I think, however, that the question of exactly which teams open them and under what circumstances they are opened should be very, very carefully weighed up and considered by the Egyptian authorities, and others internationally should have a very direct input into this, because the pyramids and the Sphinx are a legacy of all of mankind. And
well,
one of the things we should consider is what the ancient texts say about the sanctity and significance of these chambers and about the state of mind of those who enter them.
All right. What can you imagine might be there? In other words, maps, machines, religious literature, legacy of mankind type literature. What would
all the traditions of ancient Egypt, which are our only guideline on this matter, and which mean we do not have to imagine what is there, but rather to listen to what the ancient Egyptians say, tell us that this is material of two kinds. It's material that one could call broadly historical in nature, which records the lost story of human civilization.
Mm-hmm.
The civilization that had the capacity 12,500 years ago to conceive of this extraordinary scheme, and that date of 10,500 BC is fully evidenced in my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, and in the message of the Sphinx. So partly historical in nature, definitely a hall of records containing a sort of time capsule of information from a forgotten episode in human history. But also, the Egyptian traditions tell us that what is concealed there touches on the fundamental mystery, the mystery of the immortality of the human soul, and of how we should live our lives in order to prepare for the journey that we will make after death.
That information could change the entire world.
I believe that information could change the entire world, and I believe it was intended to change the entire world, and that it was always conceived of as that a time would come when it would do that. Look, we're looking here at a very careful attempt to hide away time capsules, and I repeat, this is in plural, two places, not just one place at Giza. And for me, this is part of the significance that we don't only have a chamber underneath the Great Sphinx, but we also have a chamber inside the Great Pyramid, the doorway to which was discovered by a robot camera in 1993. I mentioned this on your last show, but just to fill in those who weren't with us then, the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which weighs 6 million tons, has within its massive superstructure four very unusual features which are not found in any other pyramid. And these are narrow shafts which angle up steeply through the monument from inside two of the known chambers of the monument. And two of these shafts, they're just 8 inches wide and 8 inches high, about this, you could roughly fit a small dog into the mouth of one of these shafts. Two of these shafts go all the way through the body of the pyramid and exit on the outside and actually point at particularly significant stars. And the other two shafts from the lower chamber do not exit on the outside of the monument, and it was these, both the northern and the southern shaft, that were explored by the German engineer Rudolf Gantenbrück in 1993 with a very high-tech robot camera. And in the northern shaft, after a journey of approximately 80 feet, the robot came to a bend in the shaft. There were some metal objects observed on the floor which the camera could not capture in high definition, but they felt that they did not want to negotiate it around the bend unless it became stuck in the shaft. So they pulled it down. They then explored the southern shaft, and they reached the end of the southern shaft after a journey of 200 feet. And what was at the end of that shaft was a door, a portcullis door, complete with two metal handles. And this was the point at which Rudolf Gantenbrink's project inside the Great Pyramid was cancelled forthwith by the Egyptian authorities, and has never since been resumed, although in a rather parallel case to what is happening at the Sphinx, and again involving this same Egyptian official, Zahi Hawass. An announcement has been made that a Canadian team will be involved in opening that door later this year, and again there are signs of some sort of ghastly commercial enterprise surrounding this project as well. Now, if you were the survivors, let's just look at this theoretically. If you were the survivors of a lost civilization, of a civilization that was destroyed in the enormous cataclysm that brought the last ice age to an end, and a great civilization, I believe, and one with a high spiritual knowledge and purpose, if you had survived, if you were amongst the few survivors, and you had precious knowledge that you wish to pass down to the future, and if you would be far-sighted enough to know that mankind would revert to barbarism and that there would be a time of terrible darkness, perhaps for thousands of years, before humanity again reached a level where it could use this information, you would hide it away very, very, very carefully, but you would provide clues that would enable people eventually to find it. And I think that that's what we're looking at on the Giza Plateau in Egypt. We're looking at the clues that lead to specific locations. That shaft which led to that doorway was always a clue. The opening of that shaft was sealed until 1872. The last 5 inches of stone over the mouth of that shaft had been left deliberately in place. And if you walked into that, to the lower chamber in the Great Pyramid, before 1872, you would just have seen blank walls. But a very enterprising engineer went around those walls one day tapping with a hammer and found two hollow sounding points, and he chopped those through with a chisel, and lo and behold, there were the mouths of these two shafts ascending up at steep angles into the body of the pyramid. And it's in these shafts, as I say, that these discoveries were made in 1993. And I think the builders of that monument always intended them to be found, but did not intend them to be found by barbarians who would not know what to do with the knowledge hidden there.
Well, I'm not sure what that says about our present state of social affairs, but Graham, you mentioned hints. Are there any hints about when these things should be found? I mean, is there any text, anything that tells us the timeline when these things should be found?
There is a curious suggestion of this, in which is locked deeply into the entire ancient Egyptian system of knowledge, and this is connected to the changing patterns of the stars and the great cycle of the constellation of Orion, which, like all the stars in the sky, changes its positions over a 26,000 year cycle. And the effect of this change in position is to cause its altitude above the horizon to continuously rise for 13,000 years, then to fall for 13,000 years, then to rise again for 13,000 years. And if we go back to the beginning of that cycle, we find ourselves in the period when this incredible site was originally conceived, which I'm absolutely adamantly certain is the epoch of 10,500 BC. And it is now a simple astronomical fact that we're at the end of the current cycle. We're at the highest altitude, whereas at that time the stars were at the lowest altitude. We were then at the first time of Orion, Osiris, and we are now at the last time, what would be in astronomical terms literally the last of days. And there is a strong indication in that material that this is the time we live in now. Of course, you're speaking in terms of vast expanses of thousands of years, and you would have to say give or take 100 or 200 years, but it is our time. This appears to be the time that this was intended to happen. And when I look around the world and see the state and the mess that we are in, it frankly seems to me that this is indeed the time when we desperately need a vision from the past, something that will shake us up and help us to understand that we must, absolutely must, find a new direction in life as a species if we are not to completely blow it, completely waste and destroy the opportunity we've been given. And that's why I'm so concerned about the projects that are taking place at Giza. I'm concerned with the secrecy surrounding these projects, and I'm concerned that objects could actually be removed from those chambers, and it could be taken away without the rest of us knowing anything about it whatsoever.
Now, I don't know a lot about pyramids, but I remember all the old movies, Graham, about the pyramids and sand shifting and walls and rocks coming down. Is it not possible that if they go blundering in the wrong way, Graham, there could be destruction?
Yes, it's highly possible. I would say it's highly possible. I would say that the ancient geniuses who created these structures had a profound knowledge of human nature and knew that greed and ego and the lust for power would come into play when these chambers were being discovered. And it is most probable indeed that they will have taken safeguards to protect against that, which still doesn't mean that the rest of us should be complacent about it. Perhaps the safeguard that they created was a psychological one. Perhaps the safeguard is us. Perhaps it's up to us. Perhaps it's up to the world community to assert definitely that these monuments are a legacy of the whole of mankind, and that the research and the projects that are taking place at them cannot be monopolized in secret by a few wealthy and powerful individuals. Perhaps that's the safeguard. Perhaps it's
maybe
awakening
it
human knowledge which will protect these chambers ultimately.
All right. One quick question, then we've got to get in phones. Here it is. My question to Mr. Hancock is by fact. If the pyramids were not built, as the scholars say it was, by thousands of unwilling workers and made long sand ramps, then tell me, Mr. Hancock, how was it built? Please be specific if you are so sure how it was not built.
Well, first of all, we can be sure that it wasn't built with long sand ramps. But there's simple engineering reasons for this. A team of human labor hauling a 2.5-ton block, and 2.5 tons is the minimum weight of a block in the Great Pyramid, cannot haul that block up an incline steeper than 1 in 10. Any steeper incline than 1 in 10 is impossible. Very detailed engineering studies have been done on this, and Robert Bovall, who is, by the way, a construction engineer, my co-author on The Message of the Sphinx, Robert Bovall and I report this information in The Message of the Sphinx in considerable detail. Now, a 1 in 10 ramp to reach the top of the Great Pyramid would have to be 1 mile long. If it were made of sand, or mud, or earth of any kind, it would collapse entirely under its own weight. The block being hauled up that ramp would cause the ramp itself to collapse. This is simple physics. The ramp would not support the weight of the block. For the only kind of ramp you could build which would be sufficiently stable to haul very heavy blocks, and I stress the minimum weight is 2.5 tons, there are blocks of 70 tons in the Great Pyramid, the ramp itself would have to be made of material as stable as the pyramids themselves. In other words, the ramps would have to be made of 2.5-ton blocks of stone as well. And a 1-mile-long ramp reaching a height of 450 feet would occupy many, many times more area, of course, and more weight, and millions of times more material than the Great Pyramid itself. That material is nowhere to be seen around the Giza Necropolis. That material that would have had to have been used to make those ramps has never been found.
Then, Graham, can you conceive of how it was done? Or is the answer that that is part of the mystery?
For me, that is part of the mystery. But I think it's clear that we are looking at a lost technology or a lost form of human knowledge. I pay attention to the many ancient Egyptian traditions that speak of priests using a kind of focused energy of the mind that they called hekau, which we primitively translate as magic, using focused energy of the mind to lift blocks of stone off the ground without effort, literally a levitation of the blocks of stone. I don't want to sound like some crazy, but you know, we are so rooted and grounded in our materialistic conception of how things can be done. Our society has conditioned us like slaves ourselves to think that difficult tasks can only be accomplished by technology, and we fail to realize that we may not be using untapped capacities of the human mind. We may have the capacity as a species to do the most wonderful and extraordinary things, to achieve almost anything we can imagine, but we've got so fixed and locked into the technological way of thinking that we always look for a technological explanation. And that's why, since we know that there is no evidence, there's no surviving evidence of a high technology from the period of 2500 BC, we therefore go along with the Egyptologists when they come up with these ludicrous theories about slaves and ramps.
Then, Graham, isn't it possible that once this is opened and it is realized that mankind has been, in effect, going entirely in the wrong direction, in the technological direction, when there was all the while another direction we should have or could have been going in, it will explode everything.
Yes, that's why this material is in fact so subversive, and why there is such hostility and opposition to it by established authorities. Because this material questions the entire foundations of modern society, and it questions the entire ethic and philosophy of modern society, which has sought, that the whole ethic of our society seeks to persuade us that we are nothing more than material beings, and that we must define ourselves entirely in material terms and in technological terms, and in terms of the objects that we possess. And so insidious and dark and ugly is this philosophy of modern society that we even come to regard other human beings as objects, and we're prepared to visit mass destruction on them without the blink of an eye. People use the bodies of other human beings as though they are objects to be traded. There was a case in England recently of two men who murdered a small child. They used his body and then murdered him and disposed of the body without a second thought, without a qualm, without a conscious. Monsters like that are the creation of our society.
It's happening all over the world, Graham.
Yes, it's happening. It's happening all over the world. And thank God something else is happening all over the world as well, which is that people are waking up to the other side of our character, to the possibility that we are capable of transcending ourselves, that we have something wonderful within us, something divine as well as
something dark, and that we can reach that, but that if we stay locked in the mindset of the late 20th century, locked in the mindset of technology and objects, and fail to realize our spiritual potential, then it's going to be a terrible loss. So I think we're at a crucial, critical turning point in the life of mankind.
Is it possible, Graham, very quickly, because we're coming to the top of the hour, we never did get close, is it possible that we will miss it, that Orion will come and go, and mankind will not get to this information, and or worse yet, lose it?
Yes, I think it's entirely possible that we will miss it. I think it's entirely possible that we will miss this this window of opportunity that exists at the moment.
All right, I promise.
Think it's very possible, but I also think it's possible that we can seize the opportunity.
All right, I promise we go to the phones. Relax, Graham. We'll be back to you. That hour just went. Graham Hancock is my guest. You're listening to CBC, where Southern California comes to talk. D.C., once again, Graham Hancock. Graham, if you could answer one quick question, then to the calls. It's a fax from Torrance, California. Would you please ask Graham about a tool that Moses used to write the Ten Commandments? In his book, The Sign and Seal, he says that Moses went into the clouds on Mount Ararat. When he returned after using this tool, he had to cover his face. Was this some sort of powered tool? How was it powered? Was it a laser? What could it have been?
Thank you for that for that question. It was while I was writing The Sign and the Seal, which is my quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, that I first started to bump into these strange echoes of a kind of lost system of knowledge from long, long ago. Strange descriptions of objects and artifacts that seemed out of place in time and didn't fit with the orthodox view of history at that time. And actually, I think that the person who sent the fax is getting a couple of points that I made in The Sign and the Seal mixed up. There is a strange tool, I guess would be the word for it, that I refer to in The Sign of the Seal, which was known as the shamir, the stone that cuts rocks, or in some translations, the worm that cuts rocks. And this strange device was said to have cut through the hardest of rock without creating any friction or heat, that it was to have been soundless in operation, and to have had such a nature that it had to be kept in a lead container, that any other form of container would be become dangerous because of it. And this strange object is said in ancient Judaic traditions to have been used in the construction of the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem, because there was a prescription against using iron tools in the cutting of the ashlar blocks of the Temple of Solomon. And therefore it is said in many ancient Judaic traditions that the shamir was used instead, some kind of device that we don't understand, which was capable of cutting the hardest rocks. They said that it could engrave tiny letters onto jewels. If we look at it in terms of modern stuff, it sounds like some kind of laser.
Like some kind of laser.
With an energy source. Now, the other point that the person who sent the fax makes is right. The Bible tells us that Moses, in fact, went up Mount Sinai twice, two periods of 40 days. At the end of the first 40-day period, he came down supposedly with the Ten Commandments written on two tablets of stone by the finger of God, and he found the Israelites worshipping the golden calf, and the Bible says that he destroyed the two tablets of stone at that time. He then returned back up the mount of Mount Sinai, spent another 40-day period there, and came down with two more tablets of stone. And this time, when he came down, his face is reported to have glowed so horribly that all his followers were terrified, and that ever afterwards, until the end of his days, he had to wear a veil over his face. It sounds like he was burnt. And when you listen to the descriptions of what went on at the top of Mount Sinai in the Bible and in extra-biblical sources, it does sound very, very odd. And for me, the answer to this, and this is, it was really the research I was doing on that that led me to the research of Fingerprints of the Gods and from there to the message of the Sphinx, because this is the background of Moses is the crucial issue. Moses grew up in the household of a pharaoh of Egypt. In fact, he was groomed as a potential pharaoh, and this means that he would have been initiated into all the high wisdom and knowledge of ancient Egypt. And I think that much of the magic and miracles associated with Moses needs to be understood in context of his Egyptian background as a high initiate, as a high priest, in fact, in the Egyptian tradition. And even the Ark of the Covenant itself, I found, has precedence in Egyptian traditions. Golden boxes are described, which when opened produce a jet of flame that comes out and burns, consumes anybody standing around them. That's exactly what the Ark of the Covenant did.
And we are not to open that, are we?
I would say not, no.
All right, let's go to the phones. We promise we've got to do it. First time caller line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Good evening.
Hi.
Where are you, sir?
Speak to both of you, Mr. Bell and Mr. Hancock.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
I'm in the San Joaquin Valley of California.
All right, go ahead.
Just two quick points. The first thing, as you notice on the back of the $1 bill, the pyramid with
yes.
the eye.
Yes.
Are you familiar with the purpose and what that means?
Well, let me tell you what the symbol meant to the ancient Egyptians. It meant the immortality of the soul. It was, they called it the Benben, and it was the top or the pyramidion, the top point of a pyramid, and you also see the same device on top of all obelisks. And it was associated with immortality. It was a symbol of immortality, and it was the primary symbol of ancient Egypt. I think, and I really think that the evidence for this is very strong, and indeed Robert Boval and I plan a second book and are working on the initial research of that at the moment, which will go into this, that the ancient Egyptian wisdom tradition, which was a tradition aimed at the spiritualization of mankind, did go underground after the destruction, the final destruction of Egyptian civilization under the jackboot of the Roman Empire, that this wisdom tradition went underground and that it has found many ways to filter through into the modern world and to express its symbolism in the modern world. And there could be no more effective way of subtly impressing that symbolism on millions and millions of people than on placing it on the most common currency, the most widely distributed currency in the world, the U.S. $1 bill.
Also, I wanted to quickly mention that as a scientist, many of my friends, I believe you know Dr. Patrick Flanagan, is that correct?
The name rings a bell, but you better remind me.
Okay, I'm holding a book in my hand that was published in 1974 called Pyramid Power by Dr. Patrick Flanagan.
I've come across the book, yes.
It's autographed to me, and in the book, it covers subjects about magnetic fields around the body.
Yes.
How it affects the body.
Yes.
He spent many days in the pyramids. Matter of fact, he slept in the pyramid. He recorded some of the dreams that he had, incredible dreams.
Yes, I can believe it.
Are you familiar with the sacred cut that he speaks of, the golden section?
Yes, indeed. And the golden section is expressed in the mathematics of the so-called King's Chamber, which we believe was a chamber of initiation. It was used in the, again, we go into this in detail in the Message of the Sphinx, but we believe that the Great Pyramid of Egypt was the culminating point of an extraordinary initiation ceremony aimed at heightening the consciousness of the initiate to an almost unimaginable level, and that the frequent out-of-body experiences which modern people who have spent the night in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid report are connected to this ancient ceremony, that the initiatory function of these monuments is still active today, that they are working all by themselves even without the cultural context that once energized them.
All right, try this out. This goes to Mr. Hoagland's work, I believe.
Yes.
Graham, the shafts in the pyramid at Giza
mm-hmm.
were used to, quote, tune, end quote, the instrument to the base frequency of the earth. Purpose? to attempt to keep the Earth in tune and prevent geologic disasters?
Well, I think that when we look at monuments like the Three Great Pyramids of Egypt, we are looking at complex, multifunctional monuments, which do many different things. Before I come to that point that you just raised, to give a couple of other examples, we know now that the Three Great Pyramids represent on the ground the three stars of the belt of the constellation of Orion. They're laid out in exactly the pattern of those three stars, and indeed in the pattern of those three stars in 10,500 BC. So they are, at one level, they're a stellar diagram. The Great Pyramid of Egypt is also a mathematical scale model of the northern hemisphere of the Earth. If you take the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by 43,200, which is not a random number, it would take me too long to explain why, but it's connected to the precession of the equinoxes, then you get the polar radius of the Earth. And if you take the base perimeter of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by the same value, 43,200, then you get the equatorial circumference of the Earth. So we're already seeing that these monuments can be at one level a model of the Earth, at another level that they map three stars in the constellation of Orion. And I think it's highly likely, I'm absolutely certain about the initiatory function of the monument, that extraordinary ceremonies took place inside them, aimed at heightening and spiritualizing the consciousness of mankind, and we express this in the message of the Sphinx. It is also highly likely that these monuments had a function related to the Earth itself and to the balancing of the Earth itself. Many people are unaware that the Three Great Pyramids stand precisely on latitude 30, and latitude 30 is exactly one-third of the way between the equator and the North Pole. This positioning is not accidental. These monuments may well have been designed to have a balancing function, and indeed we go into this to some extent in an appendix in the message of the Sphinx. And those shafts, whilst I'm certain that they had important symbolic and ritual functions, may also have had much more practical functions. So I would not dismiss that notion at all.
Here's a dumb question for you. The Mideast has always been a place that we've had to worry about war and rumors of wars. Suppose there were a war. Suppose a nuclear device destroyed the Sphinx, the pyramids, the whole area.
I think that one of the very few things that perhaps could destroy the Great Pyramid would be a direct hit with a nuclear bomb.
That's right.
Again, this is a sign of the monstrous direction that our society has turned in, that we are capable of visualizing and creating devices such as these. This is one of the terrifying things about humanity, that those things which we imagine in one generation, we bring to fulfillment in the next. And when our imaginings turn dark and evil and wicked and cruel, look what we produce. Look what we have produced in this century. The atomic bomb, the horrible specter of a nuclear destruction and of a nuclear winter, the Holocaust, the mass destruction of the First and Second World War, as I was saying earlier, the manner in which people use other human beings as objects without any conception that the human life is a precious gift to be treasured and venerated, a light shining in the darkness. We've created a society that can do this, and yes, we've created a society that has harnessed the power of the sun and that can through nuclear processes could destroy the Great Pyramid of Egypt.
Well, we have the power.
We'd all be the poorer for it if we did it.
We have the power to turn out the light.
Yeah, we do. We have the power to turn out the light on our own lives.
We have
the power to destroy the beautiful garden of experience that has been given to us. We have the power to destroy our own planet.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Hi, Graham and Art.
Where are you, ma'am?
I have a strange story to tell you.
All right. Tell us first where you are.
I'm in Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, all right.
When I was 11 years old, I had an out-of-body experience. A priest from ancient Egypt actually pulled me out of my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that I was the reincarnation of Khufu's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I joined the Illuminati, and I went to Egypt, and I was initiated in the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Cairo. When I came out of one of the mosques there, we were touring, a young boy came up to me, and he said, I know you. Mm-hmm. And thinking he might be a relative of someone I knew in the States, I said, oh, you do? And he said, yes. You're Pharaoh's daughter. Your pictures are in all the tombs.
How do you react when you hear this kind of thing, Grandma?
Well, I react with a great sense of openness of mind, because I think that I believe in reincarnation. I think we're talking in the area of belief here. Let's be very clear about this.
Yes.
When a scientist and I mentioned this the last time that we were talking on your show, when a scientist asserts and insists that there is no life after death and no such thing as reincarnation, that scientist is also making a statement of belief, not of fact, because he doesn't know. He's making a statement of his particular religious belief, and I find it a very unnourishing and unfulfilling religious belief indeed. Such scientists believe in nothing whatsoever apart from the material body. So we're in the area of belief here, and my belief, contrary to the so-called rational view of modern science, is that life is an extremely mysterious process, and that we are here to learn and to grow, that it's a precious opportunity, and I think we do come back. I think we do live many lifetimes. Can't prove it. It's just my belief. And it's a belief that has been strengthened by a deep immersion in the study of ancient texts and traditions. Now, if it's the case that we come back, then this experience that has just been reported to us may well be a valid one. And I can tell you that many, many people around the world today have a sense of an awakening memory. There is a sense that the pyramids of Egypt are operating like a beacon, drawing people towards them. And imagine this. Imagine if you were the survivors, as I spoke before, of a lost civilization with a high wisdom and knowledge, a knowledge that we do not have today, and you believed in reincarnation, and not just believed, you knew that it happened, and you knew that you would be reborn 12,000 or more years in the future, and that you knew that part of the deal with reincarnation is that you do not remember past lives, that at the most you get these faint, haunting recollections that you do not clearly remember. Perhaps you would create an alarm clock for yourself. Perhaps you would create a beacon that would draw you towards it, and an alarm clock, a symbolic alarm clock that would awaken those repressed memories of past lives. And therefore, I don't think it's necessarily to be scoffed at or entirely an accident that the Great Pyramids of Egypt have this effect on so many people, that they awaken their memories to past lives, and perhaps a whole generation
That's a fascinating concept, that they are in effect an alarm clock.
Yes, an alarm clock for the planet to wake up a generation that passed away more than 12,000 years ago and that has come back. Everything about the ancient Egyptian texts speaks of the recreation of a former world.
So that we might remember we were here. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock, huh?
Yes, hello, gentlemen. This is Steve from South Dakota.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
A very sobering and, wonderful show, Art.
Thank you.
And it's a great privilege to speak to you, Mr. Hancock.
Thank you.
If there are more humans on this earth who had the sensitivity to our world like Mr. Hancock, I really believe that we'd have a better world. I had two questions. Number one, I just purchased a tape recently called The Mystery of the Sphinx. It was an NBC special hosted by John Anthony. Yeah, Anthony West.
That's about John Anthony West's wonderful work on the Sphinx. And John West is an individual to whom we should all pay credit, because John was a lone voice crying in the wilderness for 20 years about the implications of the geological weathering patterns on the Sphinx. And John single-handedly managed to mobilize the effort and the energy that got that geological study done, which proved that the Sphinx couldn't possibly have been built in 2500 BC, that the erosion patterns alone demonstrate absolutely objectively that it's thousands of years older than that. And yes, so that's the mystery of the Sphinx. And it was first shown in 1993.
Mm-hmm. It reinforced the idea that behind the Egyptian sacred science was a complex understanding of, number systems and geometry.
Indeed,
and I've been musing over the past year or so about the possibilities of a proportional symbolic relationship between the face on Mars.
Mm-hmm. All right. I must ask you both to hold on. We'll be right back. Graham Hancock is my guest on his game for sure. Good morning, everybody. From the high deserts to the nation and beyond, you're listening to the American CBC Radio Network. to my guest, Graham Hancock, and our caller. Caller, you're back on the air again. I think you are. No, wait a minute. As soon as I press the button, you are. Let me try this. Now I think you're back on the air again.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Anyway, my first question was that I was wondering about the proportional and symbolic relationships between the face on Mars and the Sphinx in Giza, and I wanted to know if you had any, if you would reflect any ideas on what you think about it.
Let me tell you, I'm in regular contact with Richard Hoagland. He's a fellow researcher and has become a friend over the last couple of years, and I'm a great admirer of Richard's work. I think that Richard Hoagland has done incredibly important and courageous work against an enormous amount of opposition in drawing attention to these extraordinary anomalies on the surface of Mars. To certain anomalies on the moon, and to anomalies concerning our exploration of those worlds. And by FedEx this morning, I received an amazing package of material from Richard Hoagland concerning star alignments over the key landing sites on the moon at the time of the orbital mission to Mars. I highly recommend. I'm not going to reveal what these computer printouts show me, because this is Richard Hoagland's work and it's his research, and I think that Richard himself should talk about this. But what I can tell you is that it suggests a stunning series of links, not only in terms of the physical appearance. That it suggests a stunning series of links, not only in terms of the physical appearance of the monuments, but also in terms of astronomical alignments, and in terms of the very secretive exploration of these worlds by our organizations here in the United States, by our scientists. A stunning series of alignments and connections have been shown to me in these computer printouts that Richard Hoagland has prepared. I am more and more convinced that there is something very, very peculiar going on, and that there is indeed a terrestrial connection, as Richard puts it, with these anomalous structures on Mars. The material that I'm looking at is quite stunning, and I hope that you'll have Richard on to talk about this at this point.
Of course, he wanted me to have you on, almost demanded it, and it's well that I did. And I should tell you, since I had you on last, I had Professor Stanley McDaniel on, and the professor revealed new studies which are showing that in some cases the odds of the structures on Mars being anything but, some sort of normal formation, the odds against that are literally now millions.
Yes.
Millions.
Well, I would agree with him. And looking at the star maps that are presently in front of me concerning the locations of those structures and concerning the landing sites for the moon missions as well, I think that we're looking at something quite extraordinary here. And I think it's very, very urgent that this work be taken further. Everything suggests to me that there is a connection between the structures on Mars and the structures at Giza in Egypt, and that this connection is deep and mysterious, and that there are people today in America, the powers that be, who have financed the space exploration and who have kept large aspects of this secret from the public, who are aware of this.
Well, so the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Hello, this is Ken in Cerritos, California.
Yes, sir.
Oh, how wonderful to get through.
Hi.
I'd like to compliment Graham on the wonderful way he puts his book together. It's very well-read and easy to read.
Thank you.
I had a multiple question on the shafts in the Great Pyramid.
Yes.
A couple things bothered me. I was wondering why the shafts were aligned on different stars when the shafts conclude at the bases and angle off, thereby you can't see up the shafts. And I was wondering if these shafts were continued on their normal course, would they possibly align on any chambers that we are unaware of in the Great Pyramid? And I had one more question.
All right, well, hold that one. Let's tackle that one.
Let's tackle that one first. The shafts were never intended as sighting instruments on stars. The two shafts from the upper chamber, which cut all the way through the body of the monument and exit on the outside of the monument, the southern shaft of the upper chamber, targeted the lowest of the three stars of Orion's belt in 2500 BC. But it was never intended as a sighting instrument by which that star could be seen. As a matter of fact, the shaft first goes in horizontally for about 8 feet before rising at the 45-degree angle that targets it like the barrel of a gun on that star. What is intended here is a symbolic connection with the star, not any kind of sighting instrument. And secondly, in terms of hidden chambers, the most inviting shafts are the northern and southern shafts of the lower chamber, which Egyptologists on no good basis like to call the Queen's Chamber.
Right.
The northern and southern shafts of that chamber, neither of them exit on the outside of the monument. The northern shaft was partially explored in 1993 until the robot came to a curve in the shaft around which it could not be negotiated. Doesn't mean it can't be explored, but it requires further work on modifying the robot to take it round the corner.
Might there be a possibility that the shafts might be pointing to something downward rather than just upward?
Yeah, I think you're raising a very good point. My impression of all of these features of the Great Pyramid is that they were deliberately designed to stimulate inquiry and to raise questions of exactly the kind that you're asking. And the unfortunate fact is that it's only really in the last 4 or 5 years that people have started to look seriously into these implications. And I want to pay credit here to the vitally important work of my co-author, Robert Boval, who is the discoverer of the Orion correlation, of the correlation between the three belt stars of the constellation of Orion and the three Great Pyramids. And it is also Robert who calculated the alignment of the southern shaft of the lower chamber with the star Sirius, which was considered to be the celestial counterpart of the goddess Isis. Now, it's this southern shaft that terminates, as I mentioned about half an hour ago, in a mysterious door complete with two metal handles at a depth of 200 feet inside the 6-million-ton body of the monument, and every indication of a chamber lying beyond that door. It may well be that there are many, many chambers within this monument, not just one or two, but dozens, possibly even hundreds. There's plenty of room for them, and you could well be right in suggesting that the angles and pointings of the shaft suggest places to look.
Graham, what does one experience when one stands within the pyramid?
Well, for me, it's above all else a profound sense of mystery and of the sacred and of an invitation. And the invitation says, know me, work me out, work out what I am. Don't just stand there awed, but figure me out. This is what the pyramid says more than anything else. It invites me to use my mind and to try and work out what it is. And this is why I feel Egyptologists have done us such a horrible disfavor over the last 150 years by telling us that they have all the answers and that we need not think about this monument. It was meant to make us think. And through thinking, through stimulating the intellect, it was meant to heighten the immaterial, the spiritual part of ourselves.
All right. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Hello, Art Bell.
Hello. Where are you?
I am in Topanga, California.
All right.
I've had a very strange experience with Fingerprints of the Gods. Hello, Graham Hancock.
Hi. Hello. Nice to hear you.
Thanks. My cousin attempted to get Fingerprints of the Gods for me at Christmas time. She lives in Louisiana. She went into the bookstore and ordered it. She waited 4 months. At the end of the 4 months, the manager looked her in the eye and said, "This book is banned in the United States. You have to go to Canada to get it."
Good God.
Yes. I thought you'd want to know that.
Good God.
We went out the next day and bought it and disproved them.
Yes.
Do you know whether or not that book is banned by the Catholic Church? Because I know the Catholic Church is very strong in Louisiana.
I'm not aware of any formal ban on the books anywhere.
the way that the knowledge filter works in our society is to generally discourage people in one way or another, sometimes by making books difficult to get, from reading things. But
she may have run into a personal ban.
You may have run into a personal ban.
It was a personal bookstore ban.
It's quite possible.
Yeah, there's a new bookstore in town, and she can now get your books. You'll be pleased to know.
Good, I'm glad.
There's book police out there.
Yeah, well, there definitely are book police out there. There's no doubt about it.
All right, ma'am, thank you, and I've got copies here myself.
Yeah.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Hi, Art. Graham.
Hi.
And I have a question here. If Moses was inducted into all of the rites and the knowledge of ancient Egypt,
yes,
which you believe is incredibly superior, it sounds like.
Yes.
Why do you think he left all of that and decided to go off and follow what he said at the time was the one true God?
Well, I think that all of these ancient Egyptian initiates believed in only one true God, and they saw the other gods, the whole concept of multiple gods in the ancient Egyptian system is entirely symbolic. And if you get down to the basis of the ancient Egyptian scriptures, you'll find that there is a belief in one and one only self-created deity, Atum, the god, the Genesis figure who creates himself out of nothingness, out of the primordial ocean, and who then creates all life. And all the other gods are simply manifestations of him. So there's no conflict within Egyptian religion with the notion of one God. Secondly, I think that Moses had a specific mission, which has actually been incredibly successful, which was to spread into another culture the germ of the ancient Egyptian idea, to carry that off and lead to its dissemination around the world. And through Judaism and through Christianity, an offshoot of Judaism, I don't think it's an accident that in Christianity we see many features of the ancient Egyptian religion. The figure of Christ, I'm sorry if this is going to offend fundamentalist Christians, but the figure of Christ is an Assyrian figure, the once and future king, the king who is sacrificed, the God, the son of a God, who is sacrificed, and who will return, who will come again. This is precisely the symbolism of Osiris, and I think that what Moses was doing was spreading this concept, this idea, into another culture, and through that culture it has filtered down and around the world in many different ways. But I think it all goes back to a common source.
All right, Graham, you likened the pyramid, the Sphinx, to an alarm clock. You talked of reincarnation and said that if you knew that you were going to be reincarnated, you would put something there to remind yourself, to an alarm clock.
To wake yourself up.
Yes. Do you think that modern man is now hearing that alarm going off, or do you think that we have reached over and we hit the snooze button?
I think we've been asleep for at least the last 2,000 years. But I do think that modern man, large numbers of people around the world, are hearing that alarm clock. And that's why I feel that we are poised at a crossroads in the story of mankind, and that if we survive this period, then future generations will look back on our time, the time we're living through now, as a time of enormous creativity and a time of renaissance, of rebirth of the human soul. I think that there is an incredible awakening taking place all around the world. The only thing that I would urge people to realize who sense this awakening in themselves is to know that they must do the work. Do not expect initiation, enlightenment, to be handed to you on the plate in some sort of second-rate New Age text. It is necessary to immerse yourself deeply in ancient traditions. People must be prepared to do the work. When they sense this awakening within themselves, they must also be prepared to work their minds and not expect to receive it handed to them.
Graham, many modern prophets, and I never know what to think of them, but I interview many of them, predict the possibility of catastrophic
yes.
events. They, many of them will say, these don't have to happen. Others have said, it is sealed. It's going to happen.
I don't think it's sealed, but I think it's possible. I went into the whole issue of cataclysms in depth in my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, and I reported many of the ancient traditions, including those of the Maya, which speak of the coming of a terrible cataclysm. But what all of these ancient traditions, every single ancient tradition in the world that speaks of a former cataclysm and of the great and of the destruction of a great antediluvian civilization, all these traditions indicate that we ourselves, mankind ourselves, played a role in bringing that cataclysm down on our heads.
Yes.
And the suggestion is very strongly the case that if a future cataclysm will come, we ourselves will be instrumental in bringing it about, and therefore the possibility remains that we can change and transform our destiny and that we need not confront a cataclysm.
All right, East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Yes, I'm glad I got through. I'm Kay from Janesville, Wisconsin.
Glad to have you.
Hey, thanks. I have a couple questions. Well, actually, one.
All right.
It's kind of a two-parter, but it's all related. You mentioned earlier that you were afraid of the individuals that were going to be getting involved in this next, I don't know, if you want to call it an excavation or digging or whatever.
Yes, the expedition that is taking place at the Sphinx at the moment and the plans for a similar expedition to be mounted inside the Great Pyramid for the opening of the door inside that pyramid. Yes, I'm concerned about the conditions that surround these projects, about the secrecy, about the hints of heavyweight commercialization, and about the possibility of a hidden agenda, and I'm concerned that objects and artifacts of enormous significance to mankind under these circumstances could be removed from those chambers, and that other artifacts could be replaced within them, and that we may never get to the truth as a result of this.
Have you ever read the book, The Celestine Prophecies?
But yes, I have read The Celestine Prophecies.
Okay, are you kind of thinking of something on that order, where the government or whoever the powers that may be would be interested in hiding or spiriting away, so to speak, any information that might be enlightening to people, that might be a threat to...
I think there are definitely people who have an interest in hiding the potentially explosive discoveries that could be made at the Great Pyramids and the Great Sphinx, at hiding them, at keeping them from the rest of the world, of not allowing that information to come out.
I would say... saying they would have an interest in that would be insufficient. They would have to do it. They would be compelled to do it. There would be no choice.
Yes. Yeah.
It would bring everything around their heads down.
Yes, absolutely. There's a huge vested interest in the current system, and discoveries of this nature would change everything. And indeed, there are many who would wish such discoveries never to be made. And that's why I'm concerned, I repeat, about the secretiveness surrounding the project, because it makes it possible for discoveries to be made and for those important discoveries to be hidden away again and never made public, and for more sanitized and politically correct objects to be placed in the chambers instead.
Respond to this simple question before we get to the top of the hour. If the Egyptians, Graham, knew so much, why did their civilization fail? Why were they conquered by lesser nations?
Well, this is the question, is were they ever really conquered? Again and again, Egypt was invaded. If you go back through Egyptian history, the first thing to note about Egypt is that this was not a militaristic society. They were capable of defending themselves when they had to, but fundamentally this was a society that was opposed to military adventures, which concentrated on cultivating the spiritual essence of man. And that's why when the Greek historian Herodotus visited Egypt in the 5th century BC, towards the end of the story of Egyptian civilization, he was still able to describe it as the happiest, the most serene, and the most beautiful civilization that he had ever encountered. These were not people who liked to go around killing other people. Now, Egypt, during its long history, was invaded on a number of occasions. The earliest major invasion was by a people known as the Hyksos, who occupied Egypt for several hundred years. And during this period of the Hyksos occupation, it appeared that Egyptian civilization had entirely submerged and vanished.
All right,
and yet it hadn't. It resurfaced in full flower when the Hyksos were driven out.
All right, Graham, we've got to hold it there. Hold it, Graham. We're at the top of the hour. We've got to go. Relax. We'll be right back to you. Graham Hancock is my guest. We'll be right back. Graham Hancock. author of The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, The Message of the Sphinx. And here he is once again. Graham, we have some stations that join at this hour. And you really laid one on us in the first half hour, and I want you to repeat that. You've got new information about the chambers below the Sphinx. If you wouldn't mind, one more time. It's a leak that somebody
gave. Yes, we've had leaked information from a member of the team that have been granted a license by the Egyptian government to work at the Sphinx, and they're using $1 million worth of ground-penetrating radar and seismic equipment, and they're looking for chambers under the Sphinx. Now, this team, as I've outlined earlier on, is operating under conditions of total secrecy, and I am deeply disturbed about the nature of this project. And my colleague Robert Boval is as well, and so are many, many others of us who are working in this field. And we think, we ourselves are very anxious to have the research done and to find out in the proper manner what is in these chambers under the Sphinx and in the hidden chamber that we know now exists inside the Great Pyramid. But we also feel that this work is presently not being done properly in the right manner, and that it is obnoxious and wrong and extremely worrying that there is no public oversight of the research that is taking place. And we're therefore calling for these projects to be stopped, for the whole matter to be reviewed very, very, very carefully, and then for projects to be started again, but under proper circumstances with proper public oversight, no secrecy, no hidden agenda, and no commercialization. And with that said, what I'll tell you is that not everybody working on the project at the Sphinx appear to be happy with the conditions of secrecy surrounding it either, and we have had a leak from one of those individuals, leaked information, and what they tell us, what we were informed of, is that this remote sensing equipment, the ground-penetrating radar equipment that they're using, and other remote sensors have detected 9 separate chambers deep in the bedrock beneath the Sphinx, and that all of these chambers appear to contain metallic objects.
We'll call this leak Deep Chamber.
Yes.
Do you expect to be able to get more information from this person?
We are actively pursuing every avenue on this matter, and we are also calling on every concerned individual to apply pressure to get these current projects stopped, because I repeat, the grave danger under these circumstances is that the public may never learn what is in these chambers. It's perfectly possible with all this secrecy for objects to be removed from those chambers and for nobody to be told what is happening, and this is not the right condition for proper scientific research to occur in. So we think the most important thing is for pressure to be put on the Egyptian authorities to stop these projects. I spent 2 hours today with the Egyptian ambassador to Washington, presenting him with our dossier of information on this. And you mentioned, Art, I think earlier on, that perhaps a good show in the United States to investigate this matter, a powerful show with the resources to do the job, would be something like 60 Minutes.
You betcha.
And because the concentration of force is the most effective way to work, I would urge anybody who's concerned about this matter and would like to get this problem investigated to write a letter to 60 Minutes. If they get enough letters from enough people, even they will wake up and pay attention. Our media have a tendency to tamely follow the orthodox Egyptological line, but they also have a responsibility to listen to the voice of the public. And if enough members of the public write to 60 Minutes and demand that they investigate what is going on at Giza to explore the issue of this license that has been granted to a team from the United States, a team that includes geologists from Florida State University, to explore the conditions under which this license has been granted, to put the team members and the Egyptian authorities under the spotlight, then I think the veil of secrecy may begin to be lifted. And the whole background to this whole extraordinary story that is unfolding at Giza is contained in our book, The Message of the Sphinx, that I've co-authored with Robert Boval, for anybody looking for background information on that. And if 60 Minutes or anybody else wants further specific information, they can always contact either myself or Robert Boval through our publishers, who are Crown Publishers in New York.
You live at, Graham, where the forces that are at work are so powerful that there really is no hope. 60 Minutes or anybody else?
Well, I believe passionately that there is hope, and that the hope lies in a generalized human awakening, and an awakening of the ancient system of knowledge, which is a system of spiritual enlightenment. Just before the break, you were asking me how it was that Egypt, for all its wisdom, could have been destroyed.
Yes.
And I started to talk about the possibility that, in a sense, it never was destroyed. There were several periods in Egyptian history when that country was overtaken by military invaders. Sometimes the light of Egypt would seem to go out, sometimes for as long as 200 or 300 years, and then miraculously it would come back on again when the invaders were driven out. There was some secret academy, a secret group of initiates passing down the knowledge behind the scenes. They called them the followers of Horus in the ancient Egyptian tradition, and they kept this knowledge alive through thousands of years, through the ups and downs of the political misfortunes that any country will suffer. And frequently, when Egypt was invaded, as it was by the Greeks, although the Greeks physically colonized Egypt, Egypt mentally colonized the Greeks. And the whole of Greek culture became imbued with Egyptian ideas, and thus, through the Greeks, Egyptian ideas spread out around the world. And again, in a later time, although the Romans physically crushed and destroyed Egypt, nevertheless, the light of Egypt did not go out, and we're convinced that the secret wisdom, the transformatory wisdom of Egypt, passed on down through the ages in such wonderful concepts that are expressed in, for example, the Hermetic texts, which, and many people may not be aware that we owe the whole Renaissance in the 15th and 16th century to the rediscovery of these Hermetic texts, which are deeply imbued with Egyptian wisdom. So I think that the light of Egyptian wisdom is still alive in the world. It's still touching people today. People are waking up to this extraordinary system of ideas all around the world. And if enough of us get together and focus our minds and concentrate on the good in us and on what is good and what is positive and what is worthwhile in mankind, then the dark forces in society will not prevail.
And it may be that time again. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Graham.
Hi.
And Art, and thank you so much for the show.
Sure. Where are you?
I'm in St. Charles.
St. Charles.
Yeah. Missouri. I'm listening to you, Graham. I'm thinking of what Egypt was. We're told Egypt was like. I'm seeing slavery. I'm seeing a pharaoh.
Banish those images from your mind.
And I'm also seeing our dollar with the pyramid. I don't know if it still has a pyramid.
It does still
and
have
still
a pyramid.
Slavery. I'm still seeing, you know,
don't
even
see,
in our
don't see those things. There is no evidence of slavery in Egypt. There were one or two apparent pharaohs who may have been involved in a small-scale manner in slavery, but the notion that Egypt was a society that enslaved others is totally false. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever of slavery in Old Kingdom Egypt.
Too many movies.
It's too many movies. You're looking at this is the nonsensical propaganda of Hollywood. That we keep seeing these images of the pyramids being built by slaves. Anybody who has studied the pyramids closely will tell you it's impossible. This was not done by slaves.
One more question.
Yes.
I don't have the name right, but it was around the first century. Apollonius.
Apollonius?
It's like Apollo.
Apollonius of Rhodes.
Very wise. Perhaps the Christ figure changed after Constantine got his hands on it.
Yes.
You've heard of this person?
Well, I know that Constantine and the jackbooted involvement of the Roman Empire in Christianity was the worst thing that ever happened to this otherwise beautiful religion.
And there was this one man that people remembered, but not Christ. They didn't remember Christ, but they really did remember, and he really is in history. Apollonius?
Does not ring a bell with me.
All right.
I really would like to strongly stress to you that if you immerse yourself, as I have done, in the ancient Egyptian texts themselves, and they're all available in translation today, we can read all of the Egyptian books of the dead, the pyramid texts, these wonderful, the book of what is in the Duat. If you study their scriptures and ideas and look closely at their monuments, you will realize that this was a society that was filled through and through with beauty and truth and a deep and abiding understanding of the mystery of existence.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Yes.
Hello, where are you?
Indiana.
Okay, go ahead.
Did you ever see inside any of the pyramids the carvings of a pharaoh inside of a spaceship working the controls of a spaceship?
There are no carvings or inscriptions in any of the three great pyramids of Egypt. The only place where I have seen carvings which look a bit like somebody operating some kind of technological device, may or may not be a spaceship, could be a telescope, could be any kind of device, but it certainly doesn't fit with the historical picture, is in Central America. Notably in Mexico and in the Olmec area of Mexico and in the Maya, some of the Maya monuments such as Palenque, and in the Olmec area along from La Venta through Villa Hermosa in Mexico,
you can find
artifacts, carvings, very old, from the oldest strata that do appear to be people manipulating some kind of technical device.
All right, well, let me follow up. Mr. Hancock has set my mind on fire with his latest assertion of the pyramids being some sort of spiritual alarm clock. Please ask him about the Mayans and their pyramids. Could they be of the same design? Ever since I've been a child, I was fascinated by pyramids, but when I learned about the Mayan culture and civilization, became obsessed, reading everything I could, trying to understand about them, so it captures my imagination. Could these be of the same genre?
Yes, I think they are the same genre. I go into this issue in depth in my previous book, Fingerprints of the Gods, which is available in paperback recently, by the way. I go in the message of the Sphinx. We concentrate entirely on the mystery of Egypt and of the Great Sphinx and the pyramids and the spiritual implications of these monuments. But in Fingerprints of the Gods, I did comparisons around the world between many ancient civilizations, and I looked very closely at the comparisons between the pyramids of Egypt and the pyramids of Mexico. And yes, there is undoubtedly a link and a connection between these monuments. And the connection, in my view, is not a direct influence of Egypt on Mexico or of Mexico on Egypt, but it's an inherited common influence, a remote and ancient influence that touched both of those places. And it's, for me, it's particularly significant that the three most mysterious pyramids in Mexico, which are the pyramids of Teotihuacan, the pyramid of the moon, the pyramid of the sun, and the smaller pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, which run alongside the so-called Way of the Dead in the city of Teotihuacan, just north of Mexico City. Teotihuacan is a very mysterious place. But these pyramids have an enormous amount in common with the three great pyramids of Giza, and I went into that in depth in Fingerprints of the Gods. But one thing that they have in common, very important, is what Teotihuacan actually means. It means the place where men became gods. That there is an ancient tradition attaching to these extraordinary Mexican pyramids, which suggests that they were in some way involved in the spiritualization of mankind, in the recognition or the realization of the immortal part of our nature.
That is
precisely what the three great pyramids of Giza in Egypt were about. They were part, we are convinced, of an ancient spiritual science of immortality, to awaken the immortal part of ourselves, and yes, to awaken the memory of a previous life. This is entirely possible, in my opinion.
In other words, separate artifacts that, in fact, enhance the totality of the evidence, period.
Yes, definitely.
All right. It is said that at one time, the surfaces of the Great Pyramid were covered with smooth, polished stone with a mirror-like finish. Have you discovered the quarry, which was the source of the stone, and what happened to the stones? Also, what is the relationship between the capstone mentioned in the Bible and the capstone of the Great Pyramid?
Well, to answer the first question first, yes, all three of the Great Pyramids, it is known for sure, were once completely encased in polished white limestone. And from the very few surviving casing blocks, we are able to say a number of things about this limestone casing. Firstly, it was an extraordinary technological feat. There were 22 acres of limestone facing stones on the sides of the Great Pyramid. Secondly, these stones had an average weight of 16 tons each. Thirdly, they were lined up to each other with such precision that in the few remaining casing stones, it is impossible to slip even a sheet of paper, of thin paper, into the joints. The joints are so closely aligned, and the great Egyptologist William Flinders Petrie, at the turn of the century, likened the precision of the casing blocks to modern optician's work, to quote him, on a scale of acres. They were a remarkable technological feat. Now, we know that they covered the entire pyramids from earlier travelers' tales. Many of the Arabs, the Arab commentators, wrote about how the pyramids shone brilliantly in the sun with this polished white casing. What we're now seeing is the substructure that lies underneath the casing. But there was an enormous earthquake hit the city of Cairo in 1301. And it is this earthquake that shook loose the majority of the facing stones. And unfortunately, those facing stones were then, the large part of the remainder, were then quarried off the pyramids by the local population and used in the construction of large parts of Cairo. As to the source of the stone, it's the Mokattam Hills, about 20 miles away to the east of Giza, across the River Nile.
Oh, so it is known. And the capstone?
The missing capstone of the Great Pyramid is an extremely interesting matter.
We cannot be certain that it was ever in place. It is possible that the Great Pyramid never did have a capstone. I personally think it probably did have a capstone, but since it has been missing since recorded history began, we cannot be absolutely certain of this. I've climbed the Great Pyramid 3 times, and the top of the Great Pyramid today forms a perfect square, roughly 20 feet along each side. With half an additional course of masonry. What's happened is that masonry has been knocked off the top and rolled down over the centuries. There is enormous significance in Egyptian tradition attached to the pyramidion, the capstone, the top of the pyramid. It was called, as I said earlier, the benben. It was the ultimate symbol of the immortality of the soul. And my colleague Robert Boval has argued in his earlier book, The Orion Mystery, that one possibility for what may be hidden inside one of the concealed chambers in the Great Pyramid is indeed this missing capstone, that it was taken off by the high priest at a certain point and placed inside the pyramid.
Well, you'd have to wonder what would happen if they put it back.
Yes.
I had the great honor, Graham, before his death, of extensively interviewing Robert Monroe.
Yes.
And there are many who would say that what his work is the modern equivalent of what was once lost and what you have talked of tonight. So we're at the top, bottom of the hour, rather, and we've got 30 minutes to go with you. But I want you to answer that when you come back, if you would. Truly a great man, Robert Monroe and the Monroe Institute. We've talked of lives that go on, people who come back again and again and again. To Graham Hancock. Well, wait a minute, just before we go back. The whole idea of what we've been doing is to slow down the insanity going on now in the Giza area, and the pressure point that we think would be a good one would be 60 minutes. They need to contact Graham. Now, the address for 60 minutes is 555, that's 555 West 57th Street, New York, New York, 10019. Again, 555 West 57th Street, New York, New York, 10019. The fax number for 60 minutes is area code 212-975-0322. Again, area code 212-975-0322. Back now to Graham Hancock. Graham, there you go. That's a point of pressure.
That's great. Yeah, and if people put pressure on 60 Minutes, write to them and urge them to investigate what is happening at Giza concerning this license that has been granted under bizarre conditions for the excavations of the Sphinx. And if 60 Minutes wants further information, definitely the best way is for them to get in touch with me through my publishers, who are Crown Publishers of New York, and we'll take it from there.
All right, good enough. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bell, Mr. Hancock.
Where are you, dear lady?
Fayetteville, Tennessee.
All right.
A few years ago, they had an exhibit of Ramses II that came to Jacksonville, Florida, and I was living there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that it was coming here, I felt so strange. I felt like I had known this man or whatever he was, because I'd never heard of him before or since. And after the exhibit left town, I quit feeling that way. I don't know. I just had this strange feeling like I had lived in that time.
Maybe you have. So many of us today are getting this sense of an awakening, and it is powerfully connected to ancient Egypt, and all the pharaohs of Egypt, and Ramesses II was no exception, were high initiates in an extraordinary wisdom tradition. And that wisdom tradition, above all else, sought the immortality of the soul and emphasized rebirth and reincarnation.
So, Graham, maybe it's not some sort of new age craziness like the hula hoop racing across the globe, but some sort of mass memory.
Mass awakening.
It's an awakening.
I really would caution people against, however, is imagining that any of this is easy. And one of the problems I have with the so-called New Age stuff is that it tends to suggest that there is a quick and easy route to enlightenment. There isn't. We all have to do the work. Life is an initiatory journey, and we cannot cannot expect to achieve that initiation just easily at the snap of a finger, by reading some lightweight text. It's a matter. Everybody in their personal lives has to expect to work. Don't expect it to come easily. And it's a matter of how we relate to the world, how we relate to people around us, what we do with our minds, and with this precious opportunity that we've been given on this planet to learn and to grow.
First time caller line. You're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, Graham.
Hi.
Back in the early 80s, I used to watch this television. Can I give a name?
Yes. Where are you, sir?
San Diego.
San Diego. All right.
Television creature. Back in the early 80s, I used to watch a television creature called Dr. Eugene Scott.
Oh, yes.
And he used to sit on the air for hours and read from this book called, I think it was called The Secrets of the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And a book which purported that the passages in the Great Pyramid were sort of like a calendar,
mm-hmm.
that sort of pre-recorded modern history. Could you expound on that?
Well, I'm suspicious of the notion which has been expressed in some rather badly researched, in my view, that specific modern events such as, for example, the Great Depression and other events in the 20th century have in some way been prefigured by the angles of certain passages inside the Great Pyramid. I don't think the geniuses who created the Great Pyramid, the spiritual geniuses who created that, were particularly interested in predicting the ups and downs of the modern economy. I think that their focus was spiritual. I think there is a sense in which the Great Pyramid is a prophetic device, and which it is, and in which it is bringing to a focus today the energies of millions of people around the world. And I think that it was always designed to do that. But no, I don't think that it specifically predicts particular events. I think that, as a matter of fact, I don't think that any destiny is carved in stone. I think we make our own destiny as we go along, and we always confront crossroads, and we always have to make choices. And the fundamental choice in the world today is the choice between good and evil. And all the ancient texts say that evil exists in the world, and that God could not prevent evil from existing in the world, but that mankind was created with the power of choice, that we have the power to choose between good and evil. We have the power to choose the destiny that will confront us. And for that reason, I reject the notion that the Great Pyramid is specifically prophetic of particular events in our century.
Regarding current social behavior, Graham, my hopes are not met by my observation of current reality.
We live in dark times.
Yes.
We live in dark times and a dark night of the soul, and terrible forces are at loose in the world today, which are leading mankind on the path of destruction, and too many people are prepared to go along with this and to make excuses for cruel and vicious behavior towards others, and to turn a blind eye to cruelty and unkindness and wickedness in the world. And this is a terrible mistake that we are making. One thing that the ancient Egyptian texts make absolutely clear is that in the life beyond death there is a reckoning, and that we will confront with absolute clarity and truth the consequences of our own actions and also of what we failed to do during life. And that's why I think it's so important for everybody to wake up to the mystery of life and to realize that this life is an opportunity that we've been given to prepare, and not to waste it away, and not to allow the darkness that is engulfing the world to continue to spread. We can resist it, we can oppose it, and on what we do about this, we will ourselves be held accountable in the final reckoning. That I am sure of.
I am too. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Graham Hancock. Hello.
Hi, Art. Thank you very, very much. My name is David. I'm in Eugene, Oregon.
Yes, David.
And I must say, in a world full of people who use fear to motivate, you are a true soldier because you use courage and knowledge to guide us, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And for Graham, I've been to the pyramids in Chichen Itza. I was about 15. That was 10 years ago, and my father took me and my sister. And regardless of how they were built or what their tolerances between stones are, you have to realize that it took a great passion from a great many people to want to build these things and want to put them there for some reason. And all I can say is that you have to look forward and you have to realize that there is a reason for their knowledge. Let me see. No, you're absolutely correct. These when you go to these monuments with an open mind, as you clearly did, it becomes immediately apparent that you are looking at works of transcendent skill and beauty and spiritual power. The principal pyramid at Chichen Itza, which is a stepped pyramid, and it stands in the middle of the great grassy area in the center of Chichen Itza, is called the pyramid or the temple of Kukulcan. And Kukulcan was the Mayan name for the civilizing deity Quetzalcoatl, who's a very similar figure to the ancient Egyptian god Osiris, a god of resurrection and rebirth. And that pyramid of Quetzalcoatl at Chichen Itza is so perfectly situated in relation to the rising of the sun, so perfectly designed in its positioning on the earth, that on the spring equinox, an amazing effect is observed on the northern staircase. For 3 hours and 22 minutes exactly, an illusion of light and shadow creates the figure of a gigantic feathered serpent, and that was the emblem of Quetzalcoatl, undulating up and down that staircase. Now, to position the monument so precisely in relation to the rising of the sun on that particular day requires an amazing geodetic and astronomical knowledge, and yet this is just totally overlooked by our Orthodox scholars.
I have this horrible feeling, Graham, that when we, and if we ever do learn the secrets held within the Sphinx, within the pyramids, we're going to discover that we've been doing it all the wrong way.
I'm sure you're right, Art. I really completely agree with you on this. I think we've been doing it all the wrong way for 2,000 years. I think that we've gone down a sidetrack in the evolution of our consciousness. We've been held back. We've been delayed. We've been prevented by dark forces from moving along. And those dark forces are within ourselves, and it's up to us to overcome them. We cannot hand over responsibility for this to any external force. It is up to us ourselves to realize the potential for beauty and truth that lies within us. And if we do not realize that potential, then we alone are responsible for it.
All right. First time caller line. You're on the air with Graham Hancock. Good morning.
Good morning to both of you.
Where are you, pray tell?
I am in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And I had a question for Mr. Hancock, and that is my now 10-year-old son will be traveling with his grandmother, November of 1997, with John Anthony West.
Oh, wonderful. They're going to go to Egypt with John?
Yes.
Well, they'll have a marvelous journey because John has the deepest and most profound and beautiful knowledge of the mysteries of ancient Egypt.
Yes, and I've seen his video on his theories of that area as well.
Yes.
But my question to you was, I'm looking for information that my son, who's now 10, who will then be 12, that he can look at and gather knowledge about that is a truer sense of the history of Egypt. Because after listening to you and listening to my grandmother, your textbook is not necessarily what the history of Egypt is about. And
what you read in textbooks is definitely not what the history of Egypt is about. The standard Egyptological textbooks are extremely misleading, and they falsify the story of this wonderful civilization.
Right. And I'm really glad I had the opportunity to get through, because I had a question about some of your books and wondering how technical are they?
Well, I find I give many talks, public talks, at bookshops and at conferences, and I find that many young people attend those talks, and I frequently got through to people of under 10 years of age, and the new book, The Message of the Sphinx, does contain technical information concerning astronomy, but it's all backed up with very, very clear diagrams which help the more difficult ideas to be understood. And I would say, for all of us, the sooner we start doing the work, the better. As I've always say, never expect it to be easy. And the younger we start on the journey of discovery, the better. I'm not trying to sell my books on the air, but unfortunately, there are very few books around which you know, look at Egypt from what I think is the true point of view. And I would urge your son to have a look at The Message of the Sphinx, have a look at Fingerprints of the Gods, have a look also at the Orion Mystery.
The Orion Mystery, that was the other one. I couldn't remember the name of.
That's Robert Bavard's previous book, and then he and my previous book was Fingerprints of the Gods, and both of these books deal extensively with Egypt, and then we got together to write The Message of the Sphinx. Now, I feel it's my responsibility as an author to write books that are readable. Above all else, a book has to be read. I try to tell a story which is a readable story and which will not bore the reader. But at the same time, to convey truthful and solid information, and that's why I always include footnotes in my book. But don't be put off by that. The information is all there, and I think it is accessible to young people.
Well, that's great. We also homeschool, so it's going to be a great adventure to have a year and a half to work on the information.
That's great. That's the way to do it. And I'm glad you put the emphasis on the word work, because we all have to put our minds into gear on this.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exercise that muscle.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you, dear, and
okay.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Yes. Take care. Time is short. Wildcard line. You're on the air with Graham Hancock.
Yeah, Art?
Yes.
I'm calling from San Diego.
Yes, sir.
And I've got two questions for Graham.
All right.
The first question I have is that, how do you think the Islamic fundamentalists of Egypt will react if they find out what's going on at Giza, especially with the discoveries that could be discovered there?
All right, that is a good question.
I think that there is this curious political background to what is happening in Egypt, which needs to be taken very carefully into account. There is, unfortunately, in extremist Islam, a tendency to believe that anything which precedes the Quran is knowledge that should not be known. There's a story concerning the burning of the great library at Alexandria in Egypt, which I suspect is probably not a true story, because the first Muslims were great learners and great guardians of knowledge. But nevertheless, for what it's worth, I'll tell you the story. When the Muslims from Saudi Arabia invaded Egypt shortly after the time of the Prophet Muhammad, they found this amazing library containing reputedly a million scrolls, all the collected knowledge of the ancient world. And they sent message back to the Caliph Umar in Iraq, and they asked him, what are we to do with this library, and his reply was the following. If it contains material which is contradictory to the Quran, then it is against God, so burn it. And if it contains material which is in the Quran, then it is superfluous, so burn it. And as a result, the Great Library of Alexandria was burned.
I'm so afraid, Graham, that the knowledge contained in the chambers of the Sphinx, the pyramids, when it is finally opened, will receive a similar order.
Yes, but I'm afraid, I want to stress very strongly that I don't think the threat to this knowledge comes from today, from Islamic fundamentalists. It comes from the powerful, wealthy, and secretive groups that are controlling research over that site at the moment for their own personal agendas.
My friend, listen, we're out of time.
I'm sorry to hear that, but I do want to stress that we can put a stop to this bad project that is taking place at Giza, and a good one can replace it. We don't need to fear the fundamentalists. We need to fear the forces in our own society.
Graham, where do you go from here?
Well, I'm going. I'm still traveling. I'm going from here to South Africa, where I'll be spending a week. Fingerprints of the Gods and the Message of the Sphinx has recently been published there. And then finally, I'm going on to Australia for a week, and I get back to England on the 27th of July.
Your entire body is going to be a mess for the next year.
Yes, absolutely. I'm sort of revolving around the planet in opposite directions twice within a month.
Graham, my friend, it has been a pleasure, and when you next grace these shores, we want you back.
I look forward very much to talking to you, Art. I think your show is a great forum for ideas and discussion and awakening the good spirit in people all around the world. And that's just what I'd like to close on, that there's so much goodness in people, and it's in all of us. And all we need to do is to reach for it and make it strong, and we can send the darkness away.
Thank you, Graham.
Thank you.
I wish you a safe journey.
Thank you very much. Good night.
Good night, and take care, my friend. Graham Hancock, author of Fingerprints of the Gods, The Sign and the Seal, The Message of the Sphinx. If you are concerned, write to 60 Minutes. Urge them to investigate what is going on at Giza. 555 West 57th Street, New York, New York, 10019.